I want to welcome everybody with us this morning. Glad that we can be together on this Lord's Day to encourage and edify each other and to study more about God's Word. Last week, we discussed the importance of believing in the legitimacy of and the validity of the Bible as God has given it to us. And we looked at this from a perspective I mentioned last week that this was going to be from a perspective first of looking at it from our faith, from our standpoint of if we believe that God truly is all-powerful and we believe that the Bible gives us the information that God is indeed all-powerful, then we know that He has the power to preserve His Word as He sees fit and that we can trust that. We can trust what God has given us. When we first started, these are just four. This is not certainly a comprehensive list of perhaps areas in which people may attempt to raise some kind of a doubt or be skeptical regarding believing in the truth and so forth. But these are four areas that sometimes people will bring up as an excuse or as a reason not to believe in God, or at least not to necessarily view the Bible as a literal guide and commandments from God to eternal life. So what we're going to do, and as we mentioned earlier last week, when we focused on these two parts, we focused on that first part first, dealing with our faith, and then now this second part today is dealing with these particular issues, these thoughts that people have and sometimes are actually promoted in our society by different factions who seek to undermine or cause people to question the legitimacy of the Bible. So we're going to be talking about these four issues today. We're going to be starting with the fact that the claim is that the Bible hypocritically leaves out other inspired books. And in doing so, we're going to be addressing the claims that question the integrity. So we started focusing on us, and now this is going to be our effort to explain to people why we believe in the Bible, and why these issues that people want to bring up and bring out don't bother us, because there is a answer. When people bring to us these doubts or these skepticisms, these reasons for not believing in the Bible, we can have an answer for this. To start with, talking about hypocritically leaving out other inspired books, I want you to challenge them. Okay? If anyone tells you that the Bible has left out something that needs to be in the Bible, have them name one. Odds are 9 out of 10 aren't going to be able to even say one of the purported letters or books that have been left out of the Bible. But challenge them. Say, well, name one so we can talk about it. I mean, you can make a broad claim, oh, there's books the Bible left out. But let's talk about which one specifically that you have in your mind. I want to quote Bart Ehrman. He's a New Testament scholar. He wrote, "The practice of Christian forgery has a long and distinguished history. The debate lasted 300 years. Even within Orthodox circles, there was considerable debate concerning which books to include." And he's writing this, he's making this statement to bring up the idea that there are books that have been left out. He also believes that the Bible is made up of thousands of mistakes and that some of them were deliberate. So while he calls himself a New Testament scholar, he's not a believer. Okay, he looks at this from an elementary point of view, not from a belief point of view. But I want you to consider that this is, given that this is what we're up against, let's consider what these books are. Because he says, there's considerable debate which books to include. Well, let's talk about some. There's the Epistle of Barnabas, was written somewhere around 70 to 130 AD. The Epistle of Barnabas, so-called, because it's claimed to be written by Barnabas. I don't believe that it is. But anyway, this epistle speaks against Judaism and sees the New Testament as superseding Mosaical law. Well, on that count, I suppose we would probably all agree the fact that, yes, the old law has been fulfilled, The new law has taken its place, and Judaism is no longer the means by which we serve God. I don't have a problem with that. However, it's these next two that I have a little bit of an issue with. It also claims that the Jews were never in a covenant relationship with God, and that Jewish traditions are not accurately interpreted. While the Jews had their own ways of viewing prophecy, to say that they were never in a covenant relationship with God is simply not true, not the way God tells us in His Word. And then finally, it claims to have special knowledge regarding Christianity. With a lot of these letters, and all of these are available online, if you wanted to read them for yourself, you can. That way you have specific notes you can take, and you can actually reference the actual words of these epistles and so forth. But what's interesting is a lot of these epistles are going to bring up this concept of special knowledge. And that concept, gnosis, it really, that's the base fundamental element of what we call Gnosticism. This idea that certain individuals had certain things to tell that were only revealed to them. And as a result, this epistle of Barnabas, that I do not believe was written by Barnabas, claims to have special knowledge. In other words, in order for you to gain this special knowledge, you have to come to me, whoever the writer of this epistle was. And this was a problem, especially going into the 50s and 60s AD. This was becoming more and more prevalent, even going as late as the 90s AD. In many ways, John, the things that John wrote in the Gospel of John, the epistles of John, they address this idea of Gnosticism to a certain extent. But a lot of these so-called letters or books that have been left out of the Bible, they refer to secret knowledge that God hasn't revealed to you, He's only revealed it to me. Whereas that flies directly in the face of everything we're taught in the New Testament, that God has revealed all things to us through His Word. Then there's the Shepherd of Hermas. This was written somewhere around 120 to 160 AD. And this letter or book, man claims to have received visions from God instructing him regarding new mandates, mainly moral mandates. If you think about this, and all of these are going to share similar themes, similar concepts, and similar kind of basis for, upon which they were received or given. And a lot of this, we're going to think about the Book of Mormon. We're going to think about Doctrines and Commandments and Pearl of Great Price, all of these books that man has come up with, that this knowledge was only revealed to him. Wasn't revealed to a whole multitude or generation of people, only to that one individual, in Book of Mormon's case, Joseph Smith's particular case. It was only revealed to him. Well, this is not new. Joseph Smith, create or make that up. This is really borrowed from 2,000 years ago, that this has been going on. Man has claimed to receive new instructions, but only to me. And it also refers to a son of God as a virtuous man that was filled with a pre-existing spirit who was adopted as the son. So again, a variation of what is taught in the gospel, but not the same. Not the same. And that's going to be true with all of these books, that they teach, there's just a little bit of kernel of truth in all of these. Some basis upon which, at one point, they took the truth, and then they twisted it or turned it into something for a purpose, for a reason. There's always an agenda with these letters. And in this case, the Shepherd of Hermas, he wants people to follow him because he has special knowledge. It's only been revealed to me. I've been given visions. And there's a different sort of Son of God that is being taught. Then you have the Gospel of Thomas. This kind of made its rounds information-wise about, I don't know, 10 years ago or so. It was kind of going around on the internet and articles and stuff. The Gospel of Thomas, between 60 and 140 AD, supposed to have been written by Thomas. It wasn't. But it claims to have, again, notice the phrase, secret knowledge that Christ revealed only to those who were closest to Him. And so someone writing in the name of Thomas, seeking to gain attention, saying since Thomas was also, you know, he was there, and he received special knowledge. And so this individual is using that special or secret knowledge to push forward an agenda. It does not deal with doctrine, and by doctrine I mean teaching, which is to say there is nothing in it that confirms what the Bible teaches us regarding what we must do to be saved or anything else, but rather experiencing truth. It focuses on the feeling, the thought processes, the emotions of an event, of experiencing truth, as opposed to actually knowing and then following truth. And we talk about, well, experience, well, you know, you apply God's word in your life. Maybe that's what they mean by experience. No, no, no. No, salvation is achieved not through following God's word, knowing His word and following it, but through insight and experiencing truth, which is to say that truth is not definitive, is really kind of what it boils down to. That the accurate truth really depends on how you experience it. And your truth is going to be different than somebody else's truth because you experience it yourself, whereas somebody else has a different experience with it. And so this is what is being pushed in the Gospel of Thomas. Then we also have the Gospel of Judas. This is another one that a lot of people talked about not too long ago. The Gospel of Judas was supposedly written around 160 to 180 AD. Notice the time frame. Okay? All these others, there's a wide kind of margin of error, but a lot of them originated, or at least the thought process as to when they were written, those estimates start in the first century. And then go into like 110, 120. Notice the Gospel of Judas. This is written a full 130 years after the church was established. So this Gospel of Judas, again, claiming to be Judas, the apostle who betrayed Jesus, this claims that Jesus had, in fact, entrusted Judas with secret knowledge. Notice your phrase again, regarding how events must unfold. And it claims that Jesus instructed Judas to hand him over to the Jews, and it claims that none of the other apostles, save for Judas, understood Jesus' teachings. Isn't it interesting? Because Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, and Acts all give us a certain view of Judas based on these men, and here's what happened. And Judas betrayed Jesus. Okay? Well, the way the Gospel of Judas is positioned to say, oh yeah, but you're only hearing one side of the story. See, the truth is Judas wasn't a bad guy. He was the good guy. He was told by Jesus that he must do this all along. So, in essence, then, Jesus was just play-acting. He and Judas were kind of just making a kind of a dramatic theater here for the sake of all the other apostles. They've got this secret understanding and this secret relationship, and Judas has this secret knowledge that none of the others know. But for their benefit, Jesus plays as if Judas is my betrayer. And, you know, Judas, somebody's gonna turn me over and, you know, well, who is it, Jesus? Who is it, Jesus? And so all of this was kind of just pomp and circumstance that Jesus went through, in essence, making Jesus out to be a liar. For all intents and purposes, that's what the Gospel of Judas does. It suggests that Jesus was lying. At the very best, you could say he was being deceitful. And certainly, that's not the Jesus that I read about in the New Testament. Then we have the Didache, written between 70 and 120 AD. This one claims that every disciple and teacher must be received for 2 or 3 days. So anybody claiming to teach the Gospel of Jesus, you receive them for 2 or 3 days. But if they stay longer, they are false teachers seeking money. And when it says they stay longer, like it doesn't matter what they say. If they stay longer than 2 or 3 days, they're just there trying to steal your stuff. And then it says that baptism is essential, but if enough for immersion is not available, then pouring water 3 times was acceptable. So now you begin to get a feeling or an idea where some of the basis for which the Catholic Church began substituting other means of baptism, which is to say immersion, minus the immersion. The pouring of water in people who are bedridden and so forth, well, that counts as baptism. They didn't just necessarily make that up. There was a basis in some of these letters that were written from antiquity by individuals with their own agendas, seeking again to push certain beliefs that they originated, that they started. So when we think about all of this, I want you to note this. M.R. James makes this statement. He's from the late 18th century, or late 19th century rather, into the 20th. He says, people may still be heard to say, after all, these apocryphal gospels and acts, as you call them, are just as interesting as the old ones. It was only by accident or caprice that they were not put into the New Testament. The best answer has always been, and is now, to produce the writings and let them tell their own story. And it will very quickly be seen that there is no question of anyone's having excluded them from the New Testament. They have done that for themselves. That's one of the best quotes I have ever seen on the matter of all these forgotten gospels and this unfair treatment of all these other books that speak about Jesus and about God that were hypocritically left out of the Bible. As Mr. James says here, they left themselves out. Man didn't leave them out. And what it boils down to is because it was obvious. When you look at these writings and then you compare them to what the Bible has, they don't fit. Either what they teach is in complete contradiction to what the Bible uniformly and consistently teaches. There's an agenda of some sort being pushed, as opposed to those who write, especially in the New Testament, Old Testament and New Testament, the things that they wrote as a testimony and as instruction. There was no personal bias. There was no seeking to promote the self, as opposed to these lost gospels. This is certainly not a comprehensive list. These are not all necessarily of the letters and books that have been quote-unquote left out. These are the main ones, though. If you watch documentaries or you watch these shows that suggest that the Bible has left out things that need to be included, and there's a whole lot of information out there you don't have because the people in charge of putting the Bible together didn't want you to know it. Some of these gospels promote homosexuality and lesbianism. These types of writings, when you look at them, when you read them, and again, if somebody comes up to you and says, the Bible left out books, well, you tell me one. Tell me one. And then we'll get together and we'll talk about it. Because all of these letters are available online. You can read them. And your friend or neighbor can read them. And then you get together and let's talk about this stuff. Let's talk about what it claims that is different from everything else in the Bible. And it'll be apparent that it's not the Bible that left these out. They left themselves out. And often deliberately. They were written with deliberate intent to be different from what the gospel wrote. That was part of the appeal of writing, to have people coming after you because you have something new. Man wants new. But God offers consistency. What about this next one? That while the Bible may be spiritually accurate from a perspective of it provides some guidance, it provides a sense of basis of morality, but historically it's not a book to be taken seriously. Well, once again, if somebody comes to you and offers this as an excuse, tell them to name an example. Give me an example of where in the Bible you feel that it is not historically accurate. 9 times out of 10, in fact, probably more so like 9.5 times out of 10 on that one, they won't be able to give you an exact example. They're just repeating what they've heard. But let's say that this is their reasoning, okay? I want to bring up to you, and part of the reason why you have the notes that you have, by the way, I meant to mention this when we first started. I know there's a whole bunch of slides on there, obviously. We're going through them pretty quickly. But the reason was I felt like I wanted you to have all of them, but if there's some of them you can't read or you want bigger ones, just let me know, and I'll print you out some on your own. Rather than leaving out certain information or slides from the notes, I wanted to include them all in there without having to staple forever. So here are the three bases that scholars, people who study ancient documents, these are the bases that people use in the scholarly field to actually examine and understand whether a book should be taken seriously, not just as a letter of some symbolism or figurative language, but rather also as historically accurate. There's the criterion of independent attestation. It's a really fancy phrase that basically means the more sources that mention an event, the more likely it is to be historically accurate. Just because an event or saying is found only in one source, that alone is not evidence that it is historically inaccurate. All other areas, okay, we're talking about all other areas of ancient documents and manuscripts. This is the rule of thumb that is used. But when it comes to the Bible, which is made up of not just one person writing a whole bunch of letters, written up of close to 60, perhaps, different individuals who all write from Old Testament to New Testament over a span of about 1,500 years, and they're all consistent in the things that they say, this is one area, that can't be, that's not true. Any effort to undermine the legitimacy of the Bible, people jump at. But when you have multiple Gospels written by different men, you've got different letters that refer to the same event that took place, that's all the more likely that obviously this actually did take place. Keep in mind, the Bible as we have it is made up of different books written by different people, all inspired by God, and then put together. So we have the criterion of independent attestation. They all attest to the same events that took place. And even at that, even if there was one event recorded by one person only, that's not evidence to say it didn't happen. You need evidence to say that that's not accurate, and people can't provide that. And then there's the criterion of dissimilarity. The more a witness or source makes claims counter to their vested interests, the more that testimony is likely to be true. We talked last week about the apostles. Here were 12 men, 11 plus Matthias, who had every reason not to continue telling people that Christ had been risen from the dead. They had every reason, every incentive to stop. And yet against all of that, they gave up their livelihoods, they gave up their own lives at times. And so that fits the criterion of dissimilarity. They had no reason to do this, yet they did it anyway. That speaks to being a valid source as well. And then there's the criterion of contextual credibility. The criterion of the two C's, if you will. Sayings, deeds, experiences must fit within the context of the era. Which is to say, the things that an individual writes, it needs to be obvious that it's from that time period to take it seriously. So when we read about certain examples, such as, here's a couple of examples that people have claimed, oh, see, the Bible's not accurate because there were no grapes in Egypt. In Genesis chapter 40, talking about one of the dreams that was had regarding Pharaoh, there were grapes involved in this telling. Well, scholars said, no, there were no grapes in Egypt. Obviously, the Bible is inaccurate. But Herodotus, in his letter on Egypt, in his recording, his historical recording of Egypt, he refers to grapes being plentiful in Egypt. And they never doubt Herodotus. But in the case of the Bible, they doubt it. Doesn't seem to make a lot of sense, does it? The Hittites, for a long time, mainstream archaeology and history claim the Hittites never existed. Now, they're just a made-up fictional faction, part of a fictional Bible. However, archaeology has found that they had an empire that rivaled Egypt and even Assyria at one time. Authorities have questioned the king of Sargon of Assyria. Oh, there has been no king named Sargon in Isaiah chapter 20, verse 1. We have all the kings of Assyria, not one king Sargon. Obviously, the Bible cannot be taken literally. It is not to be taken seriously. However, since then, they have discovered that King Sargon did exist, especially given the fact that many of these kings had different names associated with them. That's why they didn't know that they had a King Sargon. but they now know that they did. What about the flood? It's interesting, you listen to a lot of these accounts from all these different individuals. Ironically, one of the biggest cases, I believe, for the biblical flood comes from that, I forget what channel it's on, but the ancient alien show that had like five parts to it. I watched it. It was awesome. The whole point, the whole reason I watched it was because I wanted to see what these people were saying, claims of aliens. They even went to the Bible to claim aliens. You know, that whole vision that Isaiah had with the wheels within wheels, that was an alien spaceship. Anyway, the idea, though, they went to talk about the flood, and they twisted it and made it turn into alien stuff. But anyway, the point was, they went to all these different ancient civilizations, how all of them have a very similar flood story. There seems to be, in every example, there's always some kind of a vehicle by which the individual is saved, the ark. There is the main individual who is involved in this, that would be Noah. So all of these different civilizations have basically the kernel, the core of it, the details are different. And that's interesting to me. Because how did all these different civilizations, some of which started or were organized or existed in different parts of the world, all have the same type of flood story? Unless it actually happened, I find that very difficult to believe that they could just all come up with that. When you look at the Babylonian flood tablets, the archaeologies of cities that go back a couple thousand years, there was this great, huge, traumatic event that took place, and it flooded, but it was just this regional place. Then they go over to a new region. Oh, there's evidence of it. It was just this regional place. It's ridiculous. The flood happened. There's evidence, but people don't want to see it. There's also proposed dating errors, such as the city of Ai and Jericho, carbon dating and all this stuff. Oh, well, they didn't exist at the time that the Bible says that they existed. However, now archaeology has found that these very cities that they carbon dated are actually much, much older than they realized. Some of these cities were built upon other cities that were already there. So like Jericho, remember Jericho, it was rebuilt at great cost to the individual who built it, if you'll remember, because of the curse that was placed upon it. But all of this archaeology only goes sometimes to a certain level, and it doesn't go back into the past far enough. The deeper you go, the far back in time you go, further back in time. Also, what about the fact that in Moses' time, around 1400 BC-ish, there was no codified writing? Not as we know it. Certainly not enough for Moses to write Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. However, it's been proven that there was writing in Moses' time. Sodom and Gomorrah, when I say Sodom and Gomorrah, sites that bear striking resemblance. And when I say striking resemblance, we're talking about what they claim was a meteorite shower on the south end of the Dead Sea. Okay? One might even say meteorites like fire and brimstone south of the Dead Sea. Exactly where Sodom and Gomorrah existed, exactly where God destroyed that entire region. They have found the destruction. They haven't found the cities themselves. They have found the destruction, though. Even outside, historical sources confirm cities that were conquered, kings that were defeated, events that occurred that only they and the Bible report. And in all these other areas, as long as it has nothing to do with the Bible, oh, archaeologists, historians, oh, they're all over it. But as soon as it corresponds with the Bible, oh, well, that must not be accurate. Very hypocritical. But you've got Egyptian, Babylonian, Assyrian records, the Moabite stone, all of these records help corroborate exactly what the Bible tells us. Thirdly, what about the fact that it should not be read or applied literally? We've got, within the Bible, several different subsections, if you will, or categories of in which a lot of these writings fit. You've got things like poetry, which is where the Psalms fits in. You've got the parables, sayings of Jesus. You have prophecy like Isaiah and Jeremiah. You've got the letters like Romans and Philemon. You have biography, the Gospels. You have autobiography and testimony in Luke when he writes Acts and he talks about we and us. This is where we went and this is what we did. And then you have authentic historical facts that were written for the purpose of being authentic historical facts. 1st, 2nd Kings, 1st, 2nd Chronicles, and including the autobiography and testimony of many of these kind of fit in the same, some of the same subjects or subcategories. The point that I'm making is that the Bible has a reason for all of these letters and books being in it. Not one of them is specific to simple figurative or symbolic language. Even Revelation, which is largely a symbolic revelation or vision given to John in the first three chapters of Revelation, it's literal. John is accounting, he's recounting Jesus coming to him, and then Jesus is accounting or recounting this what he's writing to the seven churches of Asia. That's not figurative. There is no symbolism there. Those are literal letters, words from Jesus to those people. Some of the things he says certainly has deeper meaning, but not all of it was symbolic and figurative. And so to see that the Bible contains all of this, are there certain things that we have to understand shouldn't be taken literally because it's in context of something that is a dream or a vision? Sure. In the study of any ancient text, you consider the writer's intent, his audience, and the context of his thoughts. That's just the basic way. Any ancient manuscript, any manuscript today even, when you read it, when you look at it, you know, when we have designations in libraries of fiction and nonfiction, you know in the nonfiction, everything there is supposed to be true and factual. Fiction may be based on an event, but it is the creative process of a writer who kind of made a lot of this stuff up. Okay? We know that. Well, in this way, it can generally be understood what is meant to be historical, such as Genesis, for instance, and what is meant to be symbolic. The main group of Revelation is full of symbolism with a crucial message to the seven churches of Asia. But it is, the vast majority of it, symbolic. In imagery that conveys a message. Some of it is meant to be literal. 1 Timothy chapter 2 and in verse 12 where Paul commands that women are not to teach or have authority over a man. One time I saw an interview where this preacher from a Baptist church, I think it was a Baptist church, they were going back and looking at the Bible more. And they were trying to be more true to the Bible. And they had a woman teaching one of their adult classes and had been for decades. Well, they asked her to step down because of 1 Timothy chapter 2, verse 12. Well, the media got wind of it, and all of a sudden the headline was, "Fired for being female." Well, the person who was interviewing the preacher, she mentioned 1 Timothy 2:12 and said, "You take a rather literal view of 1 Timothy 2:12." And the preacher, to his credit, said, "Well, I'm not sure how else you would like for us to look at it when Paul says, I do not permit a woman to teach or have authority over a man." That's pretty literal. There's not really any figurative or, you know, symbolic way to take that. And to his credit, I thought that was a great answer to that. And I love the interviewer's words there. A rather literal taking of 1 Timothy 2:12. Well, yeah. But then, passages like 1 Corinthians chapter 1 and in verse 12, where Paul is describing the serious nature of some of the things that are taking place in Corinth, and he says, some of you are saying, "I'm of Paul, and I'm of Apollos, and I'm of Cephas." Was Paul crucified for you? Was Peter crucified for you? Paul actually comes out and says in 1 Corinthians chapter 4, verses 6 and 7, "These things I have figuratively transmitted to myself and Apollos and to Cephas." Because it wasn't those names necessarily they were using. Paul inserted those names figuratively to show his point that this is what you're doing. And that doesn't make any sense. But Paul comes right out and says, "I'm being figurative there." Context, and context is everything when it comes to the gospel. And it's important that people understand that. Last point for you this morning. What about the fact that the claim that it contains numerous errors and contradictions? Well, we have a theme going here, all right? Somebody tells you this, and this might be, out of all of them, between the fact that it's left out books and epistles that need to be in the Bible that aren't, and this one, these are probably the main two that we will encounter. These are the two that people really like to harp on. Have them name one. 9 out of 10 won't be able to do that. Well, you know, there's lots of contradictions, and between the manuscripts, they don't all, none of them correlate. We don't know what Jesus actually said. Have them name one. Tell me an example. Okay? Because do not let them get away with simply regurgitating things that they've heard. If they want to have an intellectual, serious conversation and study, don't let them get by with hearsay. If somebody wants to bring these types of serious skeptical accusations against the Bible, make them be specific. Having said that, remember what a contradiction is. A contradiction is defined as a statement or proposition that denies or is opposite to another. People are very liberal with their term contradiction. There are no contradictions in the Bible. None. Challenge anyone to find a contradiction that doesn't bear up under study. The harmony of the Gospels. You got four men who are recording from their perspective, their point of view, details about events. So one includes a specific detail, an extra angel sitting on top of the rolled away stone, perhaps, or the subtraction of a detail. That doesn't constitute a contradiction. Just because one writer chose not to focus in on that aspect and focuses on another. Otherwise, what's the point of having four Gospels? Why would God preserve four Gospels if they were all exactly the same? We wouldn't need them. We would only need one. All four are different for a reason. Different in what they record, in the details of what they record. Not different in that they record opposite or denying what somebody else wrote. That is not how the harmony of the Gospels works. Some people bring up Matthew 1 and Luke 3. These two genealogies don't go hand in hand. I mean, they're kind of the same for a little while, but then they kind of branch off. Really? I'm pretty sure if I go back through my mom and dad's genealogies, the same thing might happen. Because that's what happened. Both of them were of the tribe of Judah. So for a certain amount of time, they were the same lineage. But then it started branching off. Why can't they both be right? One is Joseph's genealogy, the other is Mary's genealogy. Keep in mind, Jesus was not physically of the flesh of Joseph. He was physically of the flesh of Mary. Therefore, according to prophecy, I would offer that Mary's genealogy is the more important for the fulfillment of prophecy than Joseph's. Because Jesus was of her flesh, not Joseph's. So you have two genealogies. Despite being written by possibly 40, I think I said 60 earlier, I was thinking books of the Bible. Despite being written by possibly 40 different authors, and when I say possibly, it's because certain letters don't have names attached to them, like Hebrews, over a span of about 1,500 years, there is not a single contradiction. There are perceived discrepancies that people will try to bring out that, when studied, can be explained, often very easily, or given plausible and logical explanations. There is absolutely no reason for these perceived discrepancies to all of a sudden become contradictions. Discrepancy is simply, here's one recording like the Harmony of the Gospels, and here's another recording that records it, but the details are a little different. Not contradictory. There's one extra detail here, there's one less detail there. That's a discrepancy. Discrepancy isn't a bad thing. It just shows that there's different details being shown, being told, being reported. That can be discussed. That can be given a reasonable explanation if the person's mind is open enough for it. But a lot of times, when people think, well, these don't say exactly the same thing, and they need to, so obviously you can't take the Bible at its word. That's not how it's supposed to work. Even historians and archaeological scientists, these individuals, they know better. They do. But when it comes to the Bible, they don't give it the time of day. There is never an outright opposing statement written between two things, even 1,500 years apart from the Old to New Testaments. Nothing goes against the other. That's unbelievable. If we've got 40 people together to write different things, and then somehow were to spread it out over 1,500 years, I guarantee you, they're not going to be the same. There's going to be contradictions. 40 different people. That's man. That's human. We're going to mess it up somewhere along the way, right? That speaks to the divine nature of the inspiration of the Bible, that God is the ultimate author of it. What about this statement that the originals have been copied so many times that they've lost their original meaning? This is very important. Almost every single difference between copies is either grammatical or accidental. You have an extra letter here or absence of a letter there. When taken objectively, none of the differences between manuscript copies change the passages in question. And I want to read to you, I don't know how many of you are familiar with the book Mind Your Faith by Doy Moyer. Doy wrote a great book, Mind Your Faith. If you get a chance to read it, read it. But I want to quote something that he writes regarding the number of manuscripts and copies, because he himself quotes a fellow from the book Reinventing Jesus, How Contemporary Skeptics Miss the Real Jesus and Mislead Popular Culture. So I'm going to read to you what he says. If people pressed the idea that we cannot know what the New Testament really said because we no longer have the originals, and now he quotes, then we must deny that most facts of ancient history can be recovered, because whatever doubts we cast on the text of the New Testament must be cast a hundredfold on virtually any other ancient text, end quote. The reason for this is that the New Testament manuscripts are much closer to the originals than any other text of antiquity. Further, there are more New Testament manuscripts than any other ancient work. The New Testament is far and away the best attested work of Greek or Latin literature in the ancient world. This is not debatable. Consider that together there are more than 5,700 partial and full handwritten Greek manuscripts that have been found dating between the 2nd and 16th centuries AD. And that number keeps growing as new discoveries are made. In contrast, the average number of extant manuscripts for other classical works is at 20. Think about that for a minute. Some of the other greatest manuscripts in antiquity that we have, there may be only 20 partial copies. The Bible has 5,700 copies. He goes on to say, he divides up these different categories of discrepancies. This very claim right here, that there's differences in some of the copies. Doy deals with this. He says this last category, and by last category, he deals with the category where in some form or fashion, there is a substantial difference between the recording of one manuscript to another. Okay? He says this last category is by far the smallest, comprising only about 1% of variants. These would be the ones that matter the most, but they are found the least. All other variants either do not affect the translation significantly enough to be a problem, or they are simply not viable enough to be a real issue. So while there are many variants found in the thousands of manuscripts, the bottom line is this. Only about 1% are meaningful and viable, and not one of them, even of this 1% where there is a substantial difference between what this one manuscript records and what another. For instance, our American Standard versus the King James. Sometimes I've got a few words in my version that aren't in yours, and vice versa. Okay? Doy says, in other words, we can be Only about 1% are meaningful and viable, and not one of them affects any foundational doctrine or belief. Because the ones especially in question are things like John chapter 7, Mark chapter 16. Those are the ones that people kind of center on because there's some variation between versions. But all of those, the basis of the things that are taught in those passages are taught everywhere else in the New Testament anyway. In other words, we can be certain that no truth of Scripture or Christian doctrine rests on a doubtful text. In the bigger picture, they are not nearly the problem that skeptics would have us believe. Christianity is not seriously at stake, even in the most problematic of passages. Last quote for you. No fundamental truth is lost if those, and when he's talking about those passages, for instance, John 7 and Mark 16, if those variations, if the additional sentence here or the minus of a word here is authentic, it doesn't make any difference. Because the teaching is confirmed elsewhere in these particular areas. So when we talk about the gospel and making sure that we believe and understand that we can base our faith on the gospel, understand that there is no other text in the world that has been better preserved. When you think about all of the greatest hits of the ancient world, some of the stuff we read in high school or college, and there's far less historical evidence or consistency in those copies than in the Bible. And yet the Bible is the one that is the least considered accurate. It's mind-blowing. These excuses, that's all they are, they're excuses. We should have the confidence in the Bible that God continues to preserve His Word through His power. We need to have that confidence. And then when it comes to people who bring up these things, we should be able and willing to provide a response to those who question the legitimacy of the gospel. And I again emphasize, if somebody brings something up to you and says, this is why I don't believe in the Bible, yada, 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 ask them to name an example. Make them be specific. Then we can talk. But if you're going to just kind of talk about generical type, broad type statements without anything to nail down and look at, let's look at it. But we're not going to get anywhere. Give me an example. Odds are they're not going to have one. But at least now maybe we can give a response to people who come up with these things and say, especially in these two areas of the left out, forgotten gospels, and the copies and the contradictions and so forth, those are probably the two main ones we face. We can have an answer for it. Not only for ourselves to be assured, but maybe to help them look into what you're saying first before you say it. Because they might be shocked to find out the truth of many of the claims that they've been hearing for so long. That's the lesson for you this morning. I appreciate your patience. We've gone a little bit over this morning. But I hope that this has been beneficial and uplifting for us, to encourage us, to reassure our faith that when we read the Bible, we are reading the Word of God, and that it has not changed in 2,000 years. Hasn't changed. 5,700 different copies confirm it hasn't changed. So let's make sure we believe it and follow it. We offer an invitation to those who are not Christians to become one. We offer an invitation to those who are Christians to reaffirm your faith if you're struggling, to ask for prayers of the congregation on your behalf. If you've got sin in your life, God is always waiting, and you can make yourself right with Him. And if you need the prayers of the church on your behalf, we're here for you. If you're subject, please come forward as we stand and sing.